Today on Vox Talks Economics, how much are sophisticated credit cards costing callow consumers? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. It's the beginning of a new year, 2023, and maybe your credit card has been busy recently. Now, if you've switched to one of those reward cards that gives you cash back when you spend, are you doing better or worse as a result? And how big is the overall financial difference between everyone who is doing better and everyone who is doing worse? So whatever the number that popped into your mind, spoiler alert, we're probably about to tell you a bigger one. Andrea Presbitero of the IMF is one of the authors of a new piece of research on this topic. It's just published as a CEPR discussion paper, and he joins me now. Andrea, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for inviting. It's a pleasure.
First of all, I suppose we ought to give a bit of consumer advice from your research. We like to think we use our credit cards wisely. We probably don't. What sort of common mistakes do people make?
Yeah, Tim, this is a sort of very good question. And the answer is maybe less obvious than people may think generally. In theory, credit cards are useful as a means of payment, clearly, but also to borrow, something you cannot do with a standard debit card. Mm-hmm. But credit is not cheap. So what really makes a difference is how people use their credit cards. If you do not pay in full your balance and carry it over to the following month, the bank charges you quite a high interest rate on your outstanding balances. Mm. Therefore, while you can access credit relatively easy with your credit cards, this credit card debt is also very expensive. But I would be a little bit cautious in labeling it as a mistake, as people could have good reason, in fact, to sort of borrow from your credit card. Think, for instance, that people who have to deal with emergencies of negative shocks. So credit card debt could be easier to get in a bank loan and cheaper than other sort of informal credit, like think about payday lending. That said, credit card and the data we are using in our research are a very good setup to investigate financial mistakes in credit markets. For instance, consider people who have multiple credit cards, which is pretty common in the US at least, and think on how they repay these credit cards. Given how much credit card debt you have and you have to repay, there is an optimal rule which minimizes interest costs. And this is basically you have to make first the minimum required payment on all your credit cards, and then you have to repay as much as possible on card with a higher interest rate and allocate further payments to subsequently cheaper cards. With our data, we are able actually to calculate the optimal repayment behavior for each cardholder, and then we can compare that optimal repayment with the actual payments. Misallocated repayments are much higher for individuals with low credit scores. These people in particular tend to follow some sort of suboptimal and costly balance matching heuristics, which means that they tend to repay credit cards depending on how large is their outstanding balance. Some sort of being scared by the fact that at the end of the month you have a very large outstanding balance on some cards. And this has happened regardless of the APR. So it's a clear standard sort of mistake that people do when they repay cards.
Andrea, that's exactly what I do. I know it's wrong, but I keep doing it. And as you say, I do have multiple credit cards. I was checking in my wallet and one of my cards is one of these reward cards that I mentioned in the introduction and is the focus of this research. Now, they're pretty common here in the UK. I imagine they're pretty common in the US as well. Maybe not so in other places. So how do they work?
Yeah, so you're right. Reward credit cards are more and more common. Clearly, they're dominant and they're very large in the US, but I would say in the Anglo-Saxon world, like the UK included, but they're becoming more and more common in other countries like Europe, for instance. And I was checking yesterday as well, like you, like I was looking at sort of Italian banks and they're offered more and more often. So how does it work? Basically, the reward card offers you various benefits in function of how much dollar you spend on your credit card. And rewards can come in different forms. It could be direct cashback. It could be miles and points. Mm-hmm. Cashback generally means that the credit card refunds you a small percentage of how much you purchase with your credit cards. They generally vary between 0.5 and 3%. For example, if you have a 2% cashback card and you pay out like $100 with the card, then the bank refunds you like $2 at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. Miles and point card instead let cardholders accrue bonus points that can be redeemed as a frequent flight program, and then that's generally the Miles card, or more generally like not only with airlines, but hotel, retailers, when you accumulate points. And, you know, just to give a number, like in 2019, which is basically the data that we use in our sample, the reward card account for 60% of all new credit card origination in the U.S.
Ooh.
And the largest U.S. banks pay something like $35 billion in rewards in 1 year, which is a huge number. It's more or less the same size of the entertainment industry in the U.S. Pretty big.
If that $35 billion is coming back to people just for using their credit cards, and they would have used a credit card anyway, perhaps, how can they possibly ever be worse off? Isn't this just a very sweet deal?
It's true, I agree. At first may seem strange, but indeed, it's true in many cases that people could actually worse off. I guess here the key element is that we don't have to limit our attention to one side of the coin, which is basically the rewards, how much money you get when you spend and you buy with credit cards. But you also have to consider the other side of the coin, which is the costs of using the card.
Yeah.
So rewards are in fact positive by definition, and they increase with the purchase volume. So the more you spend, the more point of cashback you accumulate. By using a credit card, there's costs too. There are fees, such as the annual fee you have to pay to have the reward card, and also like other fees like late payment if you don't repay on time. In the paper, we show that fees in relative terms are not that important. What really matters are interest charges. These are the interest that you pay, as I said before, if you carry over your balance on your credit cards. And it's quite intuitive to see that some people will be able to benefit from rewards, and these are the people who don't carry over balances. Others, which are generally called the revolvers, which is basically you in the example and sometimes also myself, will incur costs. And often these costs are large enough to offset the rewards, leading to net losses or negative net rewards, using the terminology that we have in our paper. The focus of what we do in our analysis is exactly to understand how these losses and gains are distributed across different cardholders.
So whenever we do one of these podcasts on credit card costs, I immediately go and check my statements afterwards. And I imagine quite a few people listening to this are going to be doing that as well. Now, you, in this research, well, you haven't checked the statements of millions of people, but you've used a lot of credit card data to do your analysis. Where do you get this data? How detailed is it?
Yeah, first of all, I want to assure you that I'm not looking into your credit card statement.
Not
looking into American people's credit card statement. But it's true that we use millions of information. We have very good data. And these are data which are like clearly confidential, but we can access because our data produced by the Federal Reserve Board as part of what is called the Y14M reports. These reports are collected by the Federal Reserve, meaning by the regulator, for stress testing purposes. And the Federal Reserve required large U.S. bank holding companies, those with have more than $100 billion in total assets, to report detailed information on individual credit card accounts on a monthly basis. So these data, as I tell you, are fully anonymized and basically are based on a cross-section of more than 240 million U.S. credit cards, which is close to the universe of credit cards in the U.S. And they're almost split between classing and rewards card. And they cover something about 70% of aggregate outstanding balances of consumer credit cards. We have a sample, so we can look only at the sample of credit cards in March 2019, which is a pre-pandemic period, and it's a month without any big holidays. So, you know, we are pretty much sure that any behavior is not driven by Christmas spending or Thanksgiving or other stuff. So as I said, the data are very detailed. So they are the individual credit card account, and we have information on monthly outcome, meaning how much people spend on a given card, how much they borrow on that card, how much they repay. And so we are able to compute actually the net rewards, so how much they cash in or not using this reward card. The downside of that, we don't have so much information on socio-demographic characteristic of the cardholders compared to our data. So for instance, we can do analysis on, let's say, difference across gender, age, ethnicity, all these other sort of factors.
But you still do in this research compare groups of people and do some sorting on that basis, don't you? You don't just line up people from the ones who gain most to the ones who lose most. How do you create that sort of ex ante opinion about credit card consumers?
Yeah, you're right. When you do the analysis, we need to find a way to sort of disentangle who are different people and how rewards can differ across them. So our sort of interest here is try to look at sort of some degree of sophistication of individuals. And we take advantage of that one key characteristic we observe in the data set is the credit score or the FICO score in the US. So we know the individual credit score, and actually we have the credit score like 1 year before. And then we can rank people depending on that. And we take, and so we interpret this credit score as a measure of financial sophistication. So in this sense, like low FICO individuals, which are basically the subprime or near prime consumers, we consider them sort of naive. On the other hand, high FICO score, which are called prime or super prime consumers, are considered sophisticated individuals. Clearly, it's true that the credit score could capture many other individual characteristics, such as income, for instance, and credit worthiness. So we do something more in the paper. We want to motivate the use of FICO as a proxy for financial sophistication, and we run a set of exercises in which we show that the likelihood of making financial mistakes is strongly correlated with the FICO score. As I said before, one exercise has to do with this misallocated repayment when you repay multiple credit cards. In that case, we actually show that, as I told you before, that this sort of misallocated repayments are very strongly correlated with the FICO score, suggesting again that the latter could be interpreted as a measure of sophistication. Then with the second exercise, which is interesting and also goes into this idea of making financial mistakes, we take advantage of another very good feature of our data. In that data, in fact, we can observe increases in credit limits, and we can also see that if increases credit limits is something that you ask. Sometimes you can ask the bank, you know, I need $1,000 more on my credit limits, or if they're sort of bank originated. And generally, you know, I sometimes get an email and say, oh, your credit card, now your credit limits is up by 2K or something. So we only consider the bank originated because it's something similar to sort of a supply, an increasing supply of credit. And then we can compare spending and repayment responses of consumers who receive a bank initiated credit line credit increase on reward cards and also on classic cards. So we make a comparison across classic and reward card. What we find is that all cardholders increase spending in response to a credit limit increase. But this response is stronger for reward than for classic cards. This already suggests that reward cards kind of push people to spend a lot and borrow a lot. We also see there is a visible but smaller increase in repayments. And as a result, people tend to end up with higher unpaid balances. And this is prima facie evidence that there is overborrowing on credit cards. What is really interesting, however, is that this pattern is very different between naive and sophisticated consumers. If you look at sophisticated one, prime and super prime consumers, they exhibit an increase in credit card payments, which is proportional to the additional spending. So as a result, their unpaid balances do not change. This means that sophisticated guys can take advantage of the increasing credit limits. They can push up their spending, rack in the rewards, and they just are better off. On the other hand, this is definitely not the case for subprime and near-prime consumers. For them, credit card payments do not increase at all. This suggests that they show clearly that they increase the additional spending way beyond their capacity to repay. As a result, unpaid balances increase, and naive consumers end up with large interest and charges, which very likely outweigh the benefit from rewards. So they're actually worse off from this increasing credit limit.
That's very interesting. But what I wonder about this is because your data, as you say, does not capture individual characteristics beyond the data that you're using. So how can you compare these groups and manage to screen out these differences, perhaps in sort of preferences or in types of consumer?
Yeah, as I said, like, it's true. We don't have so much individual characteristics, but we know something. We know, for instance, when the people leave. So where they're located at zip code level, we know the FICO score, and we know a couple of other characteristics. So we try to do our best as a researcher to try to make the comparison as close as possible. Because what we are doing in the exercise, we're comparing like reward card and classic cards. And we want to ideally to have like very similar people holding these two different cards. Mm-hmm. Clearly, we also control for credit card characteristics like credit limits and APR. But basically what we do, we compare cardholders in the same percentile of the distribution of the FICO score, in the same percentile of the income distribution, living in the same zip code and having an account with the same bank. So given the way in which the demographic of the US is highly segregated across zip codes, we're really making very similar comparison. Like, for instance, I'm comparing myself with Andre, one of my cohorts, we live in the same zip code, we probably have very similar income, very similar credit score, and he has maybe a reward card and I have a classic card. As you said, as you rightly pointed out, that doesn't solve the problem that still there could be difference in preferences. Like Andre and I are very, very similar along this characteristic that I mentioned, but we may have very different preferences in how we want to use classic card versus a reward card. Mm-hmm. So to try to tackle that, given that our data are sort of very large and we have a lot of observation, we can go one step farther and we can look at differences within borrowers. So we can exploit the fact that some borrowers have both a classic card and a reward card at the same bank. In this case, in the regression, like we can use basically the individual fixed effect. And this basically absorbs all sort of heterogeneity across individual, which is unobserved, like testes and preferences. And this is this case, we can do this comparison and our results basically goes through even if we do a very tight comparison within cardholders.
So can we put some numbers on this then, Andrea? How big are the gains and the losses from reward cards, taking on reward cards in your data for these different groups?
Yeah, the numbers are pretty significant in terms of like economic magnitude. So in our preferred specification, we show that net rewards are about $3.5 higher on reward card than on classic cards. Mm-hmm. So keep in mind that net rewards for us as the reward minus the cost that you bear using the credit cards. And bear also in mind that we have a cross-section which is monthly. So 3.5 is a monthly number. So annually, we're talking about we're getting closer to $50 difference, which is non-trivial. This average also is very different across the FICO distribution. Net rewards for subprime and near-prime cardholders are actually between $5 and $7 lower on reward card than on similar classic cards. So basically, low FICO score lose money having a reward card compared to sort of a counterfactual in which they would have a classic standard card with no reward attached. By contrast, on the other hand of the FICO distribution, net rewards turns positive and are on average something between $7 and even $16 higher. So that sophisticated individual actually gain quite a lot using the reward card. But again, $16 times 12, we're talking like, you know, close to $200 per year just using the reward card versus a classic card on average. So it's a big number.
Now, Andre, I was very interested in the language that you use for this paper. You have framed this as a redistribution from naive users to sophisticated users. Why look at it this way rather than a redistribution from naive users to bank profits?
Yeah, this is a tough question. It's true that most of our analysis is built around this redistribution across cardholders. At the same time, there are other aspects which are worth considering. You're basically alluding to a sort of redistribution from naive consumer to banks. And in fact, mm-hmm. we look at how banks profit from reward cards. But what we find is slightly different and probably a little bit more surprising. First, we document that the reward cards carry a lower APR, so an interest rate, than classic ones. Mm-hmm. The average APR is something about 22% of classic card, it's 18% of reward card. Basically, through lower rates, bank creates an incentive for people to apply for reward card much more often than to apply for classic cards. So basically, the lower interest rate and the expectation you're going to gain point and cashback is a very good marketing strategy for banks. Mm-hmm. Then one could imagine that banks only profit from naive borrowers while they lose money giving out cards to sophisticated individuals. People often think that this could be still efficient for the banks to hand out cards to sophisticated guys because they could gain through cross-selling of other products like mortgages, asset management services, and so on and so forth. However, what we show in the paper is that reward cards are more profitable than classic cards regardless of the degree of sophistication. So banks basically make profit through all the entire distribution when they promote reward card. What changes is the source of the profits. With naive users, banks make money mostly via interest in charges, as those people tend to be revolvers, so they carry outstanding balances at the end of the month. Sophisticated cardholders, which are often sort of transactional, are different, but then banks means they can make profit from high purchase volume, which generate a lot of high interchange fees, what people generally call swipe fees. You know, anytime you swipe your cards, you know, clearly you get some rewards, but then the banks also makes money because you're using the cards to make purchases. So to answer your question, it's not just a distribution from naive users to the bank, but more generally, there is a transfer from all cardholders to banks.
So I promised a big number at the beginning. Don't let me down. Add it all up. What's the size of this annual redistribution in the US?
Yeah, we can do an exercise to sort of illustrate the aggregate size. And so we can sum up the net rewards of reward card with positive and negative net rewards. And, you know, as we said, like the economic size is pretty large. Cardholders with negative net rewards in the aggregate pay something like $4.1 billion for using reward cards. On the other hand, cardholders with positive net rewards earn something like $1.3 billion. The difference being what the banks actually earn, which is also a big number. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that if you look within the $4.1 billion, which is the cost carried over by sort of the unsophisticated, naive guys, most come from subprime and near-prime cardholders. On the contrary, if you look at the money that people make, the $1.3 billion, only $170 million go to subprime and near-prime users, while most of the benefit goes to the sophisticated, super-prime guys. So basically, the monthly $1.3 billion positive net rewards translate into annualized redistribution, which is something north of $15 billion induced by credit card rewards. So pretty large number.
Wow. We're going to talk more about the implications of this in a moment.
which FICO credit scores are calculated is a closely guarded secret. In November 2019, we talked to Stefania Albanese about how good a job consumer credit ratings do at predicting which of us will default and how she has used machine learning to improve them. Search for the episode called How to Improve Consumer Credit Ratings.
Okay, Andrea, I'm interested in what this represents. This $15 billion redistribution from unsophisticated to sophisticated consumers. Can we talk about this as taking from the poor to give to the rich?
Yeah, that's probably the big elephant in the room. I'm surprised we haven't discussed until now, because it's generally when people think about credit cards and the distribution, they always think like a distribution from the poor to the rich. If I have to give like a short answer, I would say, oh yes, income plays a role, but it's not the entire story. But you know, I hope we have a little bit more time, so let me elaborate on this short answer. Since it's probably the key aspect that sort of motivated our project, because we want to depart from the common wisdom and provide some novel interesting insight. As you probably right imagine, like in the financial press, credit cards reward are often framed as sort of a reverse Robin Hood mechanism, in which the poor foot much of the bill for credit card points, miles, and cashback. Our results, however, show that explanation is at best incomplete. As FICO scores and income are only moderately correlated, we can study net rewards across the FICO distribution within different income groups. Mm-hmm. In our data, we are able, so I haven't said you before, but we also observe the individual income. So we can split our sample into the low income, the middle income, and the high income cardholders. And we can redo the analysis in these three buckets of income separately. And we can show that all income groups exhibit this exactly similar pattern for what is observed in the whole sample, suggesting that sophistication matters for the distribution of net rewards regardless of income. For super prime individuals, the distribution of average net rewards across income group is consistent, in fact, with the reverse Robin Hood hypothesis. High income consumers with high FICO scores benefit the most for rewards at the expense of those with the mid and low income consumers with high FICO score. At the lower end of the FICO distribution, however, the pattern is totally reversed. Mm-hmm. Overall, what we can show is that high-income consumers with high FICO scores, so super prime guys, benefit from reward credit cards largely at the expense of high-income consumers with low FICO score.
Okay, then. So there is more than one way to measure inequality, though, isn't there? And within the limitations of the data that you have, can we say anything about whether or not this redistribution is increasing inequality in other ways?
Yeah, that's the other sort of big question that we wanted to tackle when we start thinking about that. And clearly, what we do in the paper, in most of our analysis, we argue that this is a redistribution between naive and sophisticated individuals. But we also want to say this is sort of a macro relevant. This is impact also outside the sort of individual redistribution. And we want to sort of argue that the reward program are a channel through which the financial system can contribute to exacerbating existing inequalities. And there is a lot of literature on how financial market can actually sort of widen up wealth and income inequalities. So to get a better sense of how redistribution induced by the reward programs, we study the geographic distribution of net rewards across zip codes in the US. We want to understand whether the large aggregate transfer, this $15 billion that we already mentioned, is correlated with social demographic variables across US geographies. And what we find is that the average net rewards are much higher in zip codes where there is higher educational level with higher average income and with lower share of Black residents, for instance. So credit card rewards basically transfer income from less to more educated areas, from poorer to richer geographies, and from areas from high to low minorities. In this case, they actually contribute to widening existing spatial disparities. Interestingly, when sort of the estimated regression coefficient that we find in our regression becomes statistically significant and very close to zero, once we control for the average FICO score in that zip code, that basically further sort of reinforce our interpretation that all the channels, all the mechanisms are at play through this channel of like financial sophistication.
So it's become quite normal to be cynical about the way in which retail banking credit provision works. But we have to be careful about this, don't we? Do we conclude from this that people who are, let's say, people who are careless with their money end up paying more for credit? Because a lot of people would say that's not really unfair. Or can we go further than that and say that the banks are actively exploiting the naivety of some consumers?
Yeah, Tim, I think this is also another sort of tricky question.
And
I would sort of push back a little bit on your first interpretation. And I see where you're coming from, and, you know, I guess some of our results could frame in a way that could be sort of the rich and unsophisticated guys. Some of them are worse off, and, you know, should we really protect them? So what the data are telling us is that naive consumers underestimate the cost from using reward cards, while sophisticated ones rake in the benefits and they are able to avoid the cost. But this interpretation, I think, warrants a little bit of caveat around that. We define financial sophistication in a very sort of narrow way as the ability of consumers to avoid mistakes in the use of financial products, in this case, credit cards. And we remain agnostic on the source of this ability. So a lack of financial sophistication might be reflect a variety of causes. So it's not necessarily that they're sort of dumb rich kids, as sometimes people say in a very sort of sloppy way, but there are many different causes, like could be individual unawareness about their time inconsistent preferences, could be due to low level of financial literacy due to low educational attainment, or could be attention neglect due to resource scarcity. So there are many other factors as well. So understanding how this factor can affect the propensity to make financial mistakes is well beyond the scope of our paper. So we don't want to go in that direction. On your second point, instead, I would say that the results are more or less in line with the idea that banks incentivize consumers to use a rewards card by offering lower interest rate and comparable credit cards, and also like this idea that rewards will make you sometimes better off. The pricing structure clearly attracts both type of consumers, and we, and as I told you, like banks profit from both types, like the naive and the sophisticated one. But it's true that only naive ones are actually the ones which are left worse off.
So should we be doing anything about this? Should policymakers be doing anything about this? Would there be an argument in favor of, say, restricting the use of reward cards? Or does the answer lie in educating those naive consumers more?
I will start with an unsatisfactory answer, and then I will try to elaborate a little bit more. I guess in the paper, we are agnostic about policies, and we limit ourselves to document this redistribution. And I guess, like, more formally, to fully answer your question, we will need some sort of welfare analysis, which you don't have in the paper. So maybe something for a follow-up. But that said, like, let me try to answer your question. I guess I'm personally not super comfortable in using our results to support stricter restriction in the use of credit cards and reward cards. Because while it's true that our analysis show that some individuals would be better off with the classic cards and with a reward card, some other people benefit actually from a reward card. They would suffer from some sort of restriction in the program. That said, I guess more generally, some measure aimed at boosting competition in the market, in credit card market, like the one which are currently under discussion in Congress in the US, or the one which are actually in place in the European Union, in the Union there is a cap on interchange fees, which has been imposed a few years back in time, then this sort of pro-competition measure could actually weaken incentives for banks to offer large sign-up bonuses, for instance, or large rewards on reward cards. So at least they could sort of compress a little bit the market, and that's probably, and actually the regulation, which is the reason interchange fees in the EU, is the reason why sort of the program and the reward card in the EU are not as widely used in the US, where basically are everywhere. That said, I guess our analysis show that a share of credit card users do not benefit from reward cards, and that segment is mostly composed by naive card holders, and generally these are the most vulnerable people. So I think intervention could can help to sort of target this category of individuals would certainly be warranted. But I believe that sort of measure aimed at improving financial education and the awareness of the costs of incurring credit card debt could be much better targeted and more effective than sort of regulatory actions. So I guess bottom line is I strongly believe that regulators and policymakers should invest in financial literacy and financial education.
If anyone listening to this wants to take on the welfare analysis, I'd be delighted to read it. I'd be delighted to talk to you about it. Andrea, though, this is very interesting research. It's so important to be able to put numbers onto things that often we just believe or assume. So thank you very much for doing it. Thanks for talking to me about it today.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Probably want to read the paper after this. I really recommend it. It is called Who Pays for Your Rewards? Redistribution in the Credit Card Market. And the authors are Sumit Agarwal, Andrea Presbitero, Andre Silva, and Carlo Wicks. It is discussion paper 17733 at CPR if you want to get it that way.
You've been listening to an episode of Vox Talks Economics. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so that you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, why not leave us a review?